You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Well, hello, Corey.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Corey, for those that haven't come across you, tell the listeners why you've joined us today.
Yeah, so I'm a pharmacist in Tucson, Arizona. I work in ambulatory care. I do disease state management. That's my full-time gig. But I also have this thing I've been doing for several years called improv comedy. So the wide range, I know there's a lot of pharmacists out there that are also improvisers, so I'm one of many, I'm sure. But I've been doing that for about 7 years. I've been a pharmacist for 9 years. And so I've been doing comedy and teaching it, performing it, whatever. And I've developed some skills that are applicable as an improviser that I think are also really applicable as a pharmacist. And then you and I happened to cross paths on LinkedIn and talking a little bit about soft skills. And that's really the area that I think that I've developed an expertise or a comfort level that a lot of pharmacists maybe have some, we'll put it nicely, room to grow. And so I've written a little bit about it. For those, I'll do a little cross promotion on TLDR Pharmacy. I wrote an article about soft skills for pharmacy, and I've actually started developing a business where I go and teach these improv skills to healthcare providers and other businesses to help employees develop these skills.
That is really cool. Yeah, because I think I commented on your TLDR article. That was out a month or so ago?
The article came out a while ago, but I know that they'll repost it there on LinkedIn. And so
You
commented, and I commented back and said, hey, you do this awesome Business of Pharmacy podcast. You know, a big part of business is the ability of your employees to communicate and listen effectively. I do that, right. And I'm a pharmacist. So
yeah.
Here we are on a lovely Monday.
Corey, so I read that article, mm-hmm. and it talked about kind of the yes and statements, I know, which is a important part of improv. And there was just a show on that. I think it was, what the heck was it? I want to say it was You. Have you ever watched You on Netflix?
I've not.
I don't remember, but they were making kind of a spoof of that, where one of the guys was like a murderer or something, and they were telling them they had to say yes and or something like that.
Yeah, so
I forget what that was. But tell what is improv? I've seen it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so improv, I like to joke, is always made up. It's a form of theater where everything is made up on the spot. And I joke that sometimes it's also improv comedy. Like everything you see when I'm on stage is made up. And sometimes I'll actually make you laugh. The goal is obviously usually to make you laugh. And
gotcha.
So that yes and statement, that's like the first thing you learn in improv. So for your listeners, if you leave this conversation, this podcast, learning nothing about improv, it's that the two words that you can get on the inside with improvisers is yes and. And it's essentially this idea that we agree and we build together. Because if I'm doing an improv scene with you and you say, we're on the moon, and I say, no, we're not, we're in a bounce house. Well, I've completely negated the world that you've created with your simple opening statement, and now we have to rebuild everything that we've done. And so we agree, and is just building together. We add details, emotions, and consequences to whatever that scene has started. So if you say, you know, we're on the moon, I say yes, and we only have 30 seconds of oxygen left, we've like raised the stakes, we've got the audience involved, and we've added a detail that gives us a clearer picture of what's going on.
Okay, so when the person says, I'm on the moon, in that little bit of time, their mind might have just created this kind of like a dream, like when you're falling in a dream and you catch yourself and you're like, wait a minute, how did I think about that before that sound? Or let's say you're in a dream and that sound comes like of a dog barking, but you've already put it into your story.
Yeah.
But in the improv, so someone comes out with like on the moon, they've already got this like subconsciously even this like huge place to go, and you've negated it in a half a second.
Yeah. So if I say, oh no, we're in a bumpy car or whatever, I've just simply negated the reality that has existed from that initial statement. So if they say we're on the moon, and a lot of times when we're teaching improv to new people, they think that we have to make jokes to be funny. And improv actually comes from a place of simple reality building and agreeing together. And so the jokey person says, we're not on the moon, we're in a bouncy car or we're in a bounce house. And the audience laughs, but then you're like, well, crud, what do I do next? Because now we have to justify the reason why this person thought that we were on the moon.
Yeah.
And you kind of sell yourself short for this joke. instead of building this rich, deeper scene.
Tell me the history of that, of when you say improv was meant to be like this story rather than a joke. What's the history of this? And what if I'm devil's advocate and I said, well, Corey, you're just saying that because it wasn't funny. And you say, no, Mike, it was built on this. Where was the building of this?
So the building comes from the idea that improvisation is a team sport. And so when I tell people I do improv, they're always like, oh, I have some great idea for like stand-up jokes. And I'm like, and I don't usually correct them. I'm like, okay, great. Tell me what you have, because I'm not here to negate and argue with you.
Yeah, right. But you can't say no to them.
I'm like, fine, great. We'll use this in this totally made up scene next week that I'll remember. But the idea is that improvisation is a team sport. And so you can't have like a Michael Jordan or LeBron James on stage sucking away all the energy. Right. You have to rely on your other team members to either provide you with details to build upon, or you build this thing together. And so improv's been around for decades. And I think it's got a lot of theories and a lot of different schools all over the country. But the basic idea is that with stand-up, like you're telling a joke, like punchline, right. Joke, punchline, joke, punchline.
Right.
Improvisation, there's so many different forms you can do of it, but the basics of it are coming from a place of truth. Instead of creating this like kind of out there joke, you build from a simple agreement, and then you find the funny thing within that scene.
To the improv world, that's known that we're not trying to go for that quick joke at the expense of getting into this depth that really could bring out some really interesting / perhaps amusing / perhaps funny stuff.
I want you to come teach some of my improv classes, because you've just summarized exactly what I try to tell people is, and usually you get a class, or if I'm doing a workshop for a business, you have one person that like thinks they're the funny person, and so they just go for these like jokes, which you'll get a laugh, but then you're like stuck with nothing beyond that. And so and the cool thing about like this yes and idea for improv is really, I see it, and I've developed it now in 7 years. I really realize it's a life philosophy, because instead of, we say no a lot in pharmacy and healthcare, like we have to say no for safety reasons.
Right.
But I think we find ourselves oftentimes saying no to a different discipline, or even patients, like we're not listening to them. Or even like you mentioned, the idea that you come out with this big idea in your head of a scene. Well, if you're thinking of that, you're not listening to the person that is talking to you.
Yeah.
Like I do it with, like we all do it with our spouses, our kids, our friends all the time. You're already thinking of the response in your head.
Right.
And so this idea of saying yes is like, no, yes, you can't just say yes, and you can have 1,000 more Percocet just because you want it.
Yeah,
but it can
right.
be, yes, I hear that you're in pain, and let's try to find a solution to that. It's the idea that you're actually listening to what the patient or the person or the customer is saying to you, instead of just having this preconceived, like, shut off, no notion.
That is really interesting, Corey, because even before we met here, the first time, and I know I suffered from that as a kid, I was the eighth child, and so I was always trying to go for a cheap laugh, and around home it was, potty humor, and out in public I tried to tame it a little bit.
Yeah.
But I was a terrible friend. I mean, I was not a good friend through high school and stuff, because you're always looking for a cheap little gag and not listening and things. And thankfully, I guess, probably too late in life, I learned that. But I can tell, the audience can't see, but I can tell just by looking at you and your responses, your visual response to me, how in-depth you're listening, and not even in-depth until it stops, and then 1 second later you get to say what's on your mind. Because, they say, make sure you listen enough to the other person so that you're not thinking what to say while they're talking. But then I've always said, all right, I won't think about it, but you better be damn sure I'm going to talk right away when I can.
Yeah.
when it's ethical to talk. But you're like focused in truly on what I'm saying.
Yeah. And I think that's a lesson that I continually learn as an improviser, as a human being, in that when you start doing improv, sometimes we call it getting in your head, and you're just like thinking so hard, how do I come up with the next line? And sometimes with a patient or with a doctor, you're trying to convince of a therapy. You're like, how can I convince them? But if you take a step back and realize like the gift of everything you need to say is everything you're, the person in front of you is saying, whether with, it's with their words or with their body, like everything you need to respond is like right in front of you, if that makes sense. Like what you've just said or what you were just saying is all I need. I don't need to be thinking about my next response. I just need to be paying, you know, very close attention to you or whether it's the patient, because if they're on their phone not listening to me as I'm trying to counsel them on something, then they're telling me that they're not interested or they're not engaged in their healthcare. Maybe that means I need to take a different approach. With whatever you're saying verbally, like right now it's very verbal. You know, we're you and I are visual, but you know, I came on here not with like a plan to say I'm going to say X, Y, and Z today. But your questions and even your statements are prompting me to come up with the next thing to say.
Yeah. And it's everything. It's not just the words coming out. It's the visual or lack of a visual, like you talk about, of looking at a phone or something like that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the term flow state is brought about, and I can't profess to be the best improviser in the planet or in Tucson, but I can tell you the best scenes I've ever done are ones where I'm looking right in the eyes of the other person. And that's what we tell students. That's what we tell when we're coaching, is like, look into the eyes of the person across from you, and everything you need comedically in life is going to be right there in front of you. Like, trust the other person, trust yourself. And the best, you know, funniest improv scenes I've had are ones where it's like, I'm just responding to whatever is put in front of me. And the best interactions I've had with patients, with providers, it's just like, you're in the moment, you're having a chance to use that pharmacy expertise or whatever discipline you might be, and you're hearing what they're saying, and you just like, you're responding to the need in front of you.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's really about embracing the lack of control that we have. And I think pharmacists, I know you might surprise you, but I'm very left-brained. Like, I'm very type A, very like, check the box, move on to the next step. And I think that's what appealed to me as a pharmacist, is going to college. Like, I picked pharmacy at 17 years old. My chemistry teacher asked what I wanted to be, and I said a pitcher for the Chicago Cubs. And she said, you're not going to be that. So what's your real plan? And I picked pharmacy at 17, and it appealed to me, like, go to college, you get this degree, you get this job. Like, it's like very step, 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 step. And I think that's good in many senses for what we need to do as pharmacists and in healthcare. I think that it becomes a hindrance to us when, like the other day, I had a patient ask me to give them a prostate exam. It's like, how do you respond to that in a way that doesn't offend them? And I was like, well, I could do it, but neither of us are going to like it, and you're not going to get the outcome you want. So how do you like roll with that chaos? And I think pharmacists, I don't want to like criticize our profession, but I think we have a certain type of people, and it's like, how do we teach ourselves to give up that very strict control? And whether it's like a micro level with patients or on a macro level in our work environment, our job environment, where it's not like you go A to B to C to D, you get that job. Now it's like, okay, maybe we have to start creating some of our own opportunities. We have to have some innovation, and that's much more uncomfortable. So, you know, improv has helped me to embrace those moments of discomfort or chaos or unknowns.
Your chemistry teacher told you you'll never be a baseball pitcher, but you ended up in pharmacy. When was your first idea of saying improv?
So I grew up watching a lot of Saturday Night Live and The Simpsons. And so I would come to school and just, you know, quote the episode from the night before, because that was back before we could stream or DVR things. You had to watch it in real time. And so just with amongst my friends, and then I would, you know, I loved comedy. And then I got to college, and I was very pragmatic and like, I need to buckle down. My job is school. I need to focus. I mean, I went to the University of South Carolina. There's an improv student group there. I went to one of their shows. It was great. And I left there thinking, I'd love to do that. And then I didn't do it because, well, I need to be focused on my studies. And I,
right.
And I think looking back, and I think now, and for those listening, maybe if you are a pharmacy student or a pharmacist, like, I think it's super important to not have everything tied up in pharmacy. Like, you've got to have some of these other outlets. So I think and I watched Whose Line Is It Anyway as a kid. So I was exposed to improvisation. And so in college was like my first taste of like, oh, I could like do this. And then I didn't do it.
When you said you couldn't do it, it wasn't just a time factor, though. It was saying that I'm not that kind of person almost.
I think that in my head, it was like, I'm the kind of person that my job is school. I had a nice group of friends in pharmacy school, and I would make, you know, jokes during class and write little like funny things. Cause I enjoyed making light of, you know, making light of the ridiculous that sometimes can happen in pharmacy school. And I was more outgoing. I really enjoy giving presentations and talks. So when everyone else was like freaking out about a 10-minute talk, I was like, this is great. I get to go up and make a couple of jokes, maybe, you know, keep people in, you know, pharmacists are, as a whole, we could be better at presenting. So keeping people engaged in pharmacy school was a pretty low bar. And so I enjoyed all of those things.
Right.
So I think that was a bit of a self-limiting idea of like, well, I can't do this fun thing because I have to do these hard, difficult things. And then once I finish my degree, then I could, well, then I'll do a residency. But then after that, I'll really let myself enjoy myself.
And you did think that someday you would do that. You saw it and you didn't say it's not for me. You said, maybe just not now.
Right. I said, someday I'll take an improv class. So yeah. So it was a seed planted in my head.
Gotcha.
I just was like, well, I don't have any time for this. But
right.
So then I graduated from my residency, and my now wife, then girlfriend was like, my birthday was cut up, and it was like guitar lessons or improv. And if you would see the way I play my guitar, you'd understand that I did take the improv lessons. And it just kind of, it's a local theater. I still perform out here in Tucson. And I took a class and another class, and he was just getting it going. So it was like, you have a pulse, you've been through classes, you want to perform, love performing. My wife was in nurse practitioner school at the time, so she was really busy. Yeah. So I joked that I got to have my improv master's degree during those 3 years, because I just was studying every night. So I just went and performed 3, 4, 5 nights a week. Performed.
That many, huh?
Yeah, just was down there all the time, coaching, teaching, performing, really immersed myself in it.
I always thought years ago that I might be a teacher, and I realize I hate teaching. I hate, like, with my team here, like if we go through, let's say every year, maybe for the last 25 years, I've hired maybe 5-8 people a year, a lot of part-time people that are then gone the next year and so on. If I have to hire like 2 of them at a time, and if I have to say the same thing on that day, drives me crazy. I get so bored with myself. I hate hearing myself talk. Mm-hmm. And you look at these stars, like I was just watching some Billy Joel on YouTube last night, and he said that he knew when he had to maybe stop performing is when he was playing his song Just the Way You Are, you know, and he would sing the first phrase, and then he would say, I wonder what I'm going to have for dinner tonight. And then he would say the second phrase, and he said, I wonder if the, you know, the deli downstairs still has, roast beef and stuff. You know, his mind was like all over the place. It seems to me that stand-up comedy is kind of like teaching, or like Billy Joel on stage, where you've got to, you know, unless you're throwing your material out each year, some of those guys are saying the same stuff from, you know, 15, 20 years. And it seems like improv is like the opposite of that. Have you thought of stand-up versus improv?
Certainly. And I think that to give the best stand-up comedians their due, they are getting new material constantly. Like if you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts with comedians, and
yeah.
For like anyone comes out with a Netflix special, it's like that's a year or two of development to put that one special out.
Yeah, if they're coming out with that year, that's a ton of work. A lot of them are really throwing it away and coming out each year with it.
Yeah, so I think that could, and I've done a little bit of, the only stand-up I've done is actually, we have a improvised stand-up show here in Tucson I've done a couple of times. And so they'll throw you a suggestion and you have to come up with stand-up material on the spot. So
oh, that is that right?
Really my speed. But improvisation, I explain this because like I'll tell my parents or my friends, like we have rehearsal tonight. And they're like, it's all made up. What are you rehearsing?
Yeah.
And so the analogy I use is like, it's like a basketball game. You have certain rules. Like yes and is a rule of improvisation. One of our general rules is you don't ask questions. You just say statements, so that instead of, if I ask you what's going on today in an improv scene, you're like, well, I've provided nothing, and now I've put everything on you to come up with the idea. So we work on these little skills. And so improv, it's like a sport, basketball, baseball, football, whatever you're into, because you have these certain guidelines and rules that you're supposed to follow, but every game is going to be different, like within it. Like every basketball game, every game in the NBA is 60 minutes, but anything can happen within that 60 minutes, and no two games are ever going to be alike. An improv scene is very similar, is that you have these, we have different formats you can do. You can have little short games like Whose Line Is It Anyway? We have ones where people tell a story and we improvise off the story. I'm on a team where we do improvised rapping, and then we use our rapping to develop our scenes. So the same structure, same rules, but every show is going to be different.
Now, what if it was the same though? What if you, like even with this year special, okay?
Yeah.
The year special, and the guy builds like, I know it takes like a, it's kind of like animation. You know, it takes like a month to do like 7 minutes or something.
Sure.
What if you had to like say the same joke like 30 days in a row? Does that hold any desire for you, or is it really different, improv and stand-up? Stand-up in the traditional sense of memorizing a joke and saying it night after night for at least a month or a year.
I think that because I have my pharmacist brain, and I do like, despite the fact that I do improv, I do like routine. You can ask my wife all about my idiosyncrasies. Like, I think I could be happy doing either. I've just chosen this like improv path. It's the barrier to entry is a lot lower. To go down the stand-up route, there's a lot of late night open mics that I'm like, I have a kid now, so I don't want to be out at midnight on a Tuesday. Like, I got to go to work the next day. I have a kid at home.
Right.
But I think I could see a world where if it's easy for me to say not in the like mode where I have to go out there and say the same thing 30 nights in a row. But every audience is different. And every reaction is going to be different. And the mood of the crowd is always going to be different. And so you can take that, you could take the attitude, and maybe this is my yes and attitude, is like you could take the attitude, oh my gosh, it's the same thing over and over again. Or you take the attitude, oh, there's a new group of people here tonight to see this joke. They really appreciate the joke. You could have that gratitude that if someone's paying you to do jokes, the same jokes for 30 nights in a row, you've made it at some level. Like I think... Yeah. Like, I can watch the same episodes of Seinfeld over and over again, or The Simpsons, or SNL, and it's like, still works. So that to me would be a like, oh, I've made it a little bit.
I think I was watching Seinfeld, a documentary on him one time, and he was saying that, it could have been someone else, but they were saying that in the old days, let's say you didn't have a special out, and there was no YouTube and not as much social and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You could use a joke forever, for years and years. And
now,
sometimes a comedian will repeat it on purpose because it's like playing a song over. But word gets around, you know, pretty quickly now on that.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely created a different level of challenge for stand-ups or for any comedy, for any media. But I also think that as consumers of media, we're in a pretty golden age. I mean, you have YouTube, Hulu, Netflix, you know, the networks. You have all these avenues. Then what's cool is like, if you like a comedian, you can reach out to them via Twitter or Instagram or their Facebook page or whatever. You can have these interactions with the people that you really admire. And it's very parallel, I think, to the professional world where like, you saw something of mine on LinkedIn. I reached out to you. We commented to each other. We're having this conversation. And so this like world where we've created a much smaller world, I think it helps to create more opportunities, both, you know, comedically for those in that world, and I think professionally for us, if I may parallel it. Because before, as you know, in our profession, it was like, you know, you go down one path, you go down another path, and it's like, that's what you got. But now you have pharmacists creating all kinds of different businesses and innovations because they have these interests and it's easier to share them. And so, you know, I see you doing this, I'm like, oh, that would be cool to talk about what I think is a useful set of skills for a business in pharmacy.
Yeah.
And then maybe someone hears this and it's like, oh yeah, I never thought of that. So this, as bad as like the internet can be with like stealing your time and like angry people on it, I think this created this huge opportunity, especially for our profession to grow it and innovate to new levels, to new opportunities.
Yeah, that's a myth, the whole thing about the internet being a bad thing. Because you know all the stories about how years ago, you know, they didn't want to have paper because they, or even, you know, rock caveman thing because they said that you would lose the art of storytelling. And then you didn't want this because you would lose this and lose that. And it's kind of like how the Bible talks about money, I guess. Money's fine. It might be a certain desire you have for it, but it's how you use it. And certainly, golly, the internet now, it really is the first time in history that it's like, I tell my kids, I'm like, you guys don't even know. It's the first time in history that, first of all, you don't have to get through a producer or an editor or things like that. And then secondly, a free distribution. So it's just a crazy, crazy time.
I think it's, if you're good and your message connects with people, they're going to hear it and then you will grow your audience.
Well, that's what it takes, is being good. And it's similar to, you know, it's like a really pure sport like soccer. I mean, if you're good at soccer, you're good at soccer because it's so pure and you don't have to be rich or, or have everything that you would need for something like fencing or downhill skiing or something like that. I mean, that is a pure sport, just like the internet raises now up that purity of people who are good.
You have the definite, you know, people that have grown themselves. And then there's there's also the crowd that's doing their weird thing somewhere over on the dark web or whatever, but we have...
and they get their crowd too.
Yeah, exactly. There's something for everybody.
I know that you're waiting for all this and you're listening and you're tracking the eyes and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But when you've got a good zinger that you know is coming up that you've remembered from this topic, you know, going to the moon, whatever, whatever the thing is, and you've got a good joke for that,
mm-hmm.
are you like, I'm storing this one up? Or do you say, I'm going to challenge myself and not even go there? I'm not even going to use that because I really want to pay attention. Which one are you doing?
I think that it depends on the show and the audience. My improv answer is I'm gonna sit on that. I'm gonna do what best serves the scene.
Your selflessness is gonna give it to the team and see what happens.
That's the goal. And sometimes like say that there's a scene going on and it's like not funny at all. It's been like a minute. It's like I need to come out and just say something funny and then we can end it. We button the scene with a joke. The audience feels good. But if you come out and you start selling out really soon, and that's the thing is like we learn these, and it's, you know, you learn these rules to break the rules. Like sometimes we ask questions in scenes. Sometimes we start very vaguely. Like
you're not supposed to ask a question you just said.
I know.
You told me that you're not supposed to ask a question. Oh, because you're breaking that rule.
You're doing it intentionally.
Because it's not going anywhere.
Right. Or it serves the scene. So sometimes, I mean, there have been scenes where I'm in it where I'm like, I realize like, I don't know what's happening right now. So I will just say in the middle of it, so tell me exactly who you are and what are we doing here?
Gotcha.
Because if like, I don't know what's going on, the audience is like clueless. And so,
gotcha.
And then I think the audience really appreciates when you're like real with them and you're like, oh, well, it appears that they don't know what they're doing right now too. So
it's a question, but it's not a question like, why are you on a racetrack right now or something like that? It's a broad question to bring things back.
Get back to that base reality. Find out the who, what, and where, what's going on. And then you can like reset and push that scene forward again.
All right. So Corey.
Yes.
Where would you like to go with this? Where would you like to be if all of a sudden the world... word gets out that Corey's the best improv guy in the world. Where would you go with this in 5 years?
So I'm glad you asked that question because I really think that does bring it back around to pharmacy. And so I've thought about like, I'm pretty good at improv. I live in Tucson. It's not a hotbed of comedy. Like we have a pretty decent comedy scene. I have a kid. I have another on the way in June. So like,
congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I always have to give that plug for my unborn kid. Like he's coming.
Yeah.
So like the idea of like, if I wanted to make a career of comedy, get on SNL, be on sitcoms, like you're going to LA, you're going to Chicago, you're going to New York. I'm not doing that. I love my life here in Tucson. And so this is where I was kind of thinking like, where do I take my improv to the next step? And that's when I circled it all back to like, I realized like as a pharmacist, I became much more comfortable and effective as I progressed through my improv training and realized that I was applying these skills as a pharmacist. And so my goal, in 5 years, like I've started my business Improv RX. And so I go and I do these seminars, these workshops, these trainings. Like 5 years, I would love to be known as the person that could come into your team, whether it's a pharmacy, a hospital, you know, any business really. I was at an accounting firm this past week and helped to create a clearer vision for your employees, make them more engaged, help develop those soft skills so that they're more effective, they're happier employees, they're a better, stronger team. So 5 years from now, I'd love to be known as the pharmacist improviser who can come and apply these skills to your team. I mean, I would love to be known as right now too, but that's where I've decided to push my improv training because I can, you know, I want to live here in Tucson. I like being a pharmacist. But I'm not ready to, I'm not going to uproot my family to go pursue this idea of being in a sitcom. That's not what I want to do with it. And I'm comfortable with that.
It's like a big fish in a smaller pond too.
Yeah. And I think that I'm not at this point, like I'm okay traveling to other places too. Like I want to go do this wherever there's a need, whether it's in Michigan, whether it's in South Carolina, where I went to college. I'm happy to go where the need is. And I think that Tucson, I really see an opportunity, especially with the healthcare scene here in Tucson. We have a large university. We have a lot of training here there's lots of theaters that do this training. And I think that I can come at it with my experience, my professional experience as a pharmacist, my experience in dealing with some of these life or death, you know, situations and how it has served me well to make me a more comfortable speaker, to make me a more empathetic listener with my patients. And so, you know, I love my two fellow Tucsonans, and I think that there's opportunities here, but there's opportunities all over the country and the world.
It's really strange, because if I would think about somebody who said they're a comedian, mm-hmm. you know, that'd be the easiest way to say it, you know, because people maybe don't say it correctly, improv and things like that. One would tend to think they're going to be the worst listener. That's what I came from as being not a real nice person in high school, trying to always go for a cheap thing.
Yeah.
And to say that a comedian mm-hmm. is like the best listener, it's really cool. It's really strange to think about. Because, Corey, we didn't talk before this. I didn't know who I was going to find on their line of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't know if it was going to be Rodney Dangerfield on the other line or Don Rickles or something. But to think that someone in comedy is one of the best listeners you've talked to is really amazing.
Well, thank you. That's a high compliment. And I have to give a lot of credit to the theater and my friends that have trained me along the way as well. And I can't speak for every, you know, comedian. I think that we get some people that do stand up that come and want to learn how to do improv so they can do like crowd work and be more comfortable with that. And they aren't as good at the beginning because they are very focused on that punchline and that joke. And then sometimes we get people who have done theater and they really struggle with letting go of that control. A lot of improv is letting go of control. Oh. But I find that people that do really well at improv, people say, oh, I'm not funny. I can never do improv. I'm like, if you are smart people, not to like anyone can do improv, but like we have a lot of people in our company that are nurses, doctors, engineers, scientists.
Just say it. You have to be smart.
If you are smart, it serves you well.
If you're smart,
it serves you well. I will be as diplomatic with that as possible, but because you can follow rules, you learn how to listen and you can learn these things. And we mentioned how improv comes, like great comedy comes from a place of truth. Well, people bring their own life experiences into scenes. So someone who's like works at our engineering plant here in Tucson building rockets, like they're going to have a whole nother perspective on a scene about rockets or going to the moon than I am as a pharmacist. And I'll tell you what, when people, you know, my teammates love to push me into scenes where I'm a pharmacist and I'm like, great, I can do this all night long because I do it all day long too.
Right.
So we draw on those personal histories.
If you were able to do this full-time speaking, that kind of stuff, maybe some traveling, would you quit the practice of pharmacy?
That is something that I've had discussions with my wife about. And I mean, I'm so early into this, and I really appreciate you having someone who's early in their business ventures onto your podcast. Yeah. You've had some wonderful people on there.
I love it. You get the truth out of people, you know?
Yeah. I think that I always want to have a toe in the practice of pharmacy because I think it helps me relate to the challenges that businesses face and the challenges that other healthcare workers face. Now, what that means as a practicing pharmacist, if it means that I'm full-time around the country speaking and doing this or that, and then I'm doing per diem work somewhere so that I'm still practicing as a pharmacist, then that's what it looks like. If it means that I am so, you know, goodness, that would be phenomenal. If I'm so successful that I don't have time to do pharmacy, well, then maybe that's the path that it becomes. I think that's part of improv is helping me let go of this this idea that I've clung to. And I think that we sometimes are like, well, I'm going to do this job for this long. It's going to be like this, and then I'll stop doing this. And, you know, having a kid has really helped me get rid of this idea that I have any control over over anything. But it's helped me embrace that unknown, embrace that chaos a little bit. And I'm not anywhere near that yet, but if it comes to that point, you know, my wife's a nurse practitioner, and so she's still in healthcare and she's incredibly supportive of what I'm trying to do. And so if it comes to that point, then it comes to that point and I don't do pharmacy and I do this, and then maybe I come back to pharmacy or I do some sort of per dieming. That's so far down the road, or maybe it's closer than I think.
Yeah, maybe it's closer than you think.
Maybe it's closer than I think. And then I'll make that choice and I'll be at peace with that. You know, just as an individual pharmacist, I've gone from managing a Coumadin clinic during the day to teaching an improv class at night, and students are afraid of making a mistake. And I'm like, guys, you have this wonderful opportunity to make a mistake to learn. Whereas like I was training in our Coumadin clinic, and like you can't make mistakes with blood thinners. Like you can't. It's very, you know, and I'm not advocating for let's make some mistakes with warfarin to find out how. No. Like we do things very meticulously. But as a pharmacist, like when I started doing these classes, it was so liberating to come to a place for 2 hours every week where you go and you're supported and you can make these mistakes or errors and you learn from it. And it's totally disposable. Like improv's disposable comedy. You say something, you should have done something different. Great. We'll do it again. And there's of no consequence. And so I think that pharmacists, healthcare workers, like anyone that work, you know, human beings, we have very high stakes with what we're doing, whether it's raising children, your job, your finances. So you can go and play on stage for 2 hours and learn skills and have fun. And if you mess up, well, it's a learning opportunity. It's not a mistake. And that's, I think, something that I've really taken from improv is how could I learn from all of these experiences in life and healthcare and pharmacy?
Let me quiz you on that then, Corey.
Okay.
So you brought up like a Coumadin clinic, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously somewhere that you, the end product has to be true and complete and accurate and so on. You said make the mistakes for 2 hours at an improv clinic.
Mm-hmm.
Can you make that leap though to say, all right, the person's, you're just giving a talk, let's say, to the group of whoever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Where is that leap of the Coumadin clinic? Can you do things, can you improv there? I mean, besides the stage, can you improv yet at the end you have to have this perfect product?
Yeah, I think that it actually is imperative that we are able to improvise in a situation where, whether it's Coumadin, whether it's adjusting insulin with patients, because pharmacists, like credit to all the pharmacists coming out now, like they are so smart. Like pharmacists have never learned more. There's never been more opportunities to be board certified, to get these certifications that you are really good at X, Y, and Z. And I think pharmacists are by and large excellent at these hard skills. So Coumadin adjustments, insulin titrations, I have no worries about that. But where these improvisation skills come into place is when you call your diabetes patient and their wife had passed away yesterday. And so pharmacist brain's like, well, we need to go over our blood sugar numbers. But empathizer pharmacist realizes they don't care about their blood sugars right now. Let's listen to them, see how they're doing, so that the next time I call them, they're going to want to trust me. Because imagine if you were in a situation where like there's a huge life stress going on. And I think that maybe I'm too nice sometimes, but I just understand like when I call a patient and they're like, well, I didn't get my blood drawn, or I didn't get this, but I had my kid was sick or this or that. And people, like, I've been on the other end of it where the doctor is like, well, it's your health. You need to do this. It's like, yes. Most people know that. Most patients know that.
But
how can I adjust my appointment to meet the needs of where they're at today, so that the next time that I talk to them, they're going to be more apt to listen to me when I'm like, you got to get your A1C checked, or you've got to give me your sugar numbers. Because sometimes you've just got to be able to put yourself in the patient's shoes or be able to listen to what's really happening in their life and meet them at the goals where they're at. Now, like with warfarin, it's like, well, I'm eating 10 salads a day now. Okay, just tell me next time. You know, I want to help you. I want you to eat healthy. 10 salads a day is a lot of fiber, so you probably got to get off the phone soon. But it's
right.
Before something happens, let's get to you. Yeah. Let's take care of what we need. So it's, to me, it's like I'm not teaching. I don't do a lot of talks on hard skills. I do some lifestyle diabetes talks. I'm really into that. But a lot of what I'm trying to teach is how do you take what's in here, get it out of your mouth. I'm pointing at my head. Get it out your mouth, get into someone else's ears and into their heart so they care about
it.
That's my big thing.
I did a show a while back. We were talking about adherence, and your point is not a small point about the dynamics of someone's life, because I think it's like people do so much better on their animals than they do on themselves. You know, they don't stuff up for themselves. There's all this stuff going on, doubting the doctor, doubting this, you know, not caring about themselves as much and all that stuff. So it's like 90% not what's on paper. It's like those soft skills. When I hear soft skills, the first thing I'm thinking about is like how to manage someone softly. But boy, the patients, it makes total sense what you're saying about the patients really being part of those soft skills.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes us in pharmacy or nurse, in my voice, like I said, nurse practitioner, physicians, anybody, we have this training, we have this extensive training. And when someone doesn't want to listen to us, when it's like, well, I'm the expert, I should know everything. But like, I don't know everything about that person. And right. I try to, again, think of things in the big picture. So we've had these issues with generic drug recalls. All we've been saying forever is take the generic, trust us, trust us, trust us. And now it's like, well, you can still mostly trust us, but so how do we, you know, we have to understand that when patients question us, they're not just, some of them are being jerks, but sometimes yeah. they're just being curious humans that look at the data themselves and say, well, you've been saying one thing, but another thing's been happening. Or with my diabetes, you've been telling me it a certain way, but I keep gaining weight. So maybe I should try something different. So instead of taking these like questions, you know, when we're questioned, instead of taking it as like this affront, we ask, like, I yes and it, like, oh yeah, I agree. Like, yeah, I agree. I would be upset if I've been taking my blood pressure pill and all of a sudden it could have a carcinogenic in it. Like, I would be upset and let's find a solution for you. So
yeah.
And now am I going to fix every little problem each time? No, but that patient now is like, oh, this guy, he cares. He listens. He understands. He didn't fix it, but he acknowledged that there's an issue here versus every other doctor that doesn't listen to me.
They're not listening.
Yeah. That's the biggest thing I get with patients, that my biggest, the biggest satisfier I have with them is like, I actually listen to what they're talking about. We can't always fix every health issue, right? We have a limited right. amount of control. We can always agree to listen to what's happening to them. And that is a great step in developing that rapport and trust so that when we have that opportunity to make that intervention, they're going to be more likely to want to listen to what we have to say.
Your approach is really close to, in psychology, what they call dialectical behavioral therapy. And that's someone who's just really, either they've got borderline personality disorder or they've got a real rigid disorder. They just really need to see things in black and white. You know, maybe mm-hmm. the black part of it is something that happened in childhood and the white part is something they think they should be doing, but they just avoid both of them because, or else they go to one side or the other. But that grayness, we need to spend a lot of time in the gray, I think, that we're not spending in the gray. Maybe not morally, I suppose, but besides that, a lot of stuff has to be gray in life.
That was, I think, the biggest shock to me when I finished pharmacy school and started practicing, was like, I went into this profession of pharmacy where it's like, well, you just follow the treatment algorithms or the guidelines, and it's like this or that. And there is so much gray that pharmacy school, and I love my alma mater, and I think that's most pharmacy, new pharmacist grads are like, we're not prepared for all that gray area, all those decisions that are, could go this way or could go that way. What's the best choice? And I'm almost a decade into my career, and there's still a lot of times where you struggle with like the in between of that gray zone. And so, with a patient, it's just about finding what their motivations are, what they care about, and trying to start making those little changes.
I think maybe naturally that grayness, part of that is because I'm just throwing this out there, but because we don't have provider status, where a lot of times we're not making that final decision.
Yeah,
there's a lot of grayness. I know I wouldn't be used to. I wouldn't be real comfortable with it in the healthcare scene, I suppose.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And it's, again, learning improvisation has helped me learn to dance with that ambiguity and to really, I'll be honest with patients sometimes, you know, when I'm adjusting their meds, I'll say, we could do option A, we could do option B. I'm okay with either one. What are you most comfortable with? Like putting that option, you know, empowering the patient to help guide both of us through this gray zone of what it might be, because oftentimes there isn't just like one right answer. There's a lot of wrong ones. As long as we don't pick any of those wrong ones, we can get down the road the right way.
Here's the thing though. Ambiguity has been our evolution. If you want a lot of security and you're a caveman mm-hmm. sitting in a cave, if you're thinking something is a mulberry bush or a lion and you're not sure,
you are on the side of caution.
You're on the side of caution, and so you sit in there, and your brother, who didn't mind ambiguity, mm-hmm. they're the ones that goes out and says, no, I'm not sure what it is. I think it's a mulberry bush until they get eaten. Well, now that genetic line is gone. So
yeah.
we're really set up for that. Mm-hmm. We humans don't really like ambiguity.
I agree. Yeah, I think pharmacists especially, like we like to know what the next step is. We like to know what the next day holds, and it's just the reality of life is we can't know everything. And so how can we work with what we know and learn to react appropriately to the things that we don't know, react calmly, react with sound mind, react in a good team manner. And I think that's, obviously I'm on here talking about improv, so I'm going to be spouting the benefits of it, but it teaches you to live in that ambiguity and to then make a bold choice. Because we say in improv, death in improv is a medium choice. So if you make like a mild move or a pretty boring character, or if you're not sure, like if it's not clear what your character really wants, the scene's going to be boring. But if you make a strong choice, like we're on the moon and we're out of oxygen, then boom, we're there. It's a great, you've cut right to the interesting part.
What was the phrase that you said, being what is being what?
Oh, death in improv is a medium choice.
Death in improv is a medium choice.
Yeah, so you want to make a bold choice.
So if you're on that moon and you're like, well, we don't know what we're going to do, so we're going to sit here for a few days until Houston calls us. Well, now the story's dead.
It's like, we have 30 seconds, or we might have more, but it could be the reaction too. It's like, thank goodness, I don't want to go in anymore. The moon is so boring, I'd rather die than be up here anymore. Like, that would be a bold choice. Like, you wouldn't expect it. You're like, you're on the moon, it should be great. It's like, thank goodness, well, this will be over in 30 seconds. But if it was like, well, if we have 30 seconds, it could be, maybe we'll fix it, but if not, it's fine. Like, or if it's like, no, I need to keep going. I really want to, see the other side of the moon. I want to see the dark side of the moon. Right. Then you have a strong place to then build off of. But if you're unsure of how you feel, then the scene kind of just fizzles out.
If you're unsure how you feel,
you'll make a medium choice instead of a bold choice.
You'll make a medium choice because you want to have your feet on both side. You don't want to make that choice.
Yeah. And I think that this is a way, of approaching life choices too. This idea of like, heck yes or no. My wife and I have been working on that a lot because we'll get decision fatigue. So if like a friend's like, you want to go have dinner tomorrow night together? If we're like, then it's usually a no. But if we're like, oh, heck yeah, we haven't seen them in a long time. Like that helps you, make that strong choice. But I've had this with a couple of choices in my career when I've taken jobs where I was like, I think I want this. And so I did it. And I turned out I really didn't. Like that hesitancy was me saying, let's stand pat for now. So I think that that's a way I've brought the bold choice of improv into how do I make bold choices in my life? When appropriate, right? If there's a lion outside, like, heck yes, I'm staying in the cave. So I'll make that strong choice for safety.
I think people don't make choices because they're afraid of the consequences. Maybe they're afraid of failure. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely, yeah.
Is there any night that you would walk away or somebody would walk away from the theater if, let's say, you were live and they said, I broke the rules, I failed. What would it mean if you failed at improv?
I think if you failed, you would negate what your scene partners were saying. You would not listen to what was happening and kind of come in with your own ideas. You'd have really flat, boring characters. You would not say every word as if it was worth the price of admission, we say. Like every word worth the price of admission. You would make flat, boring words. You'd seem disinterested. You wouldn't support the ideas that your teammates did. You'd ask a lot of very vague questions. And so I would say that would be a failure. That and just objectively being like offensive on purpose, I think would be a failure too. We try to keep things as PG-13, we'll say, as possible.
Well, at least I'm one for two.
Yeah.
That's interesting because as you described that person there, in business, I would describe that person maybe as a jerk or whatever, mean or something. Mm-hmm. But quite often we don't label that person as afraid. Mm-hmm. That person that you describe right now in improv, somebody that would do what you were just talking about right now, what would be the deep feeling of that person, would you think?
They'd be a bad teammate.
Why?
Because they would be making selfish choices.
Why? Are they afraid? Or they just might be a selfish a-hole?
I think I've performed some selfish a-holes. So that would be one flavor. I think the person that's afraid might not even step into a scene, really. I think the fear in improv, I think you're going to get a different response. It's just they're going to be more timid. They'll make more medium choices. I wouldn't even call them a failure, though, because if they're afraid of getting on stage and they get on stage and they do improv scenes, even if they're not funny and even if they're not perfect, and heck, I know I've done plenty of very not perfect improv scenes, but if they're overcoming that fear of simply being in front of a crowd and making things up, I call them a success. But if you are on stage and you know the rules and you're ignoring them and you're being selfish, that's what I would call a failure. So I don't think the fear is necessarily as much of a factor as the improviser's attitude and selfishness versus willing to be a supporting teammate.
The selfishness would be a failure.
Yes.
Because the other one you'd be learning and the crowd would get something out of it. It just wouldn't be as good maybe, but yeah. it's not gonna fail and stop as much as a selfish person not asking the and, you know, the mm-hmm. yes and statements and so on.
Yeah, and I think that I would consider that if you get over your fear, but you're still making the same mistakes, you're not, you know, making a bold choice, you're not clearly identifying who, what, and where is going on, and these things continue for years, then I would consider this just a failure of learning to adapt and to learn. And I, at that point, that's kind of where you're at.
I imagine that you're going to teach a lot of different size audiences and different settings and all that kind of stuff. But if you had like a half hour, all of a sudden they said, Corey, you're going to be on national TV mm-hmm. some night with a half hour special about teaching the value of improv to business people in their daily life and so on.
Yeah.
What would that half hour, and you could only do a half hour.
Okay.
What would that half hour look like for a crowd sitting at home? Would you start off with a skit all of a sudden, or would you start off talking, or what would you do for a half hour that you had to teach the world about this?
I would involve the crowd immediately, because I think the value of improvisation is to understand that anybody can do it, and that by anybody can apply these skills right away.
Gotcha.
And so I might start with like a minute of like, I'm, you know, introduce who I am, what I'm there to do, right? I want to make sure the audience out there knows what the purpose of today's 30 minutes is. And then I'm going to say by the end of tonight, I'm going to convince you that anybody can improvise and that everyone will benefit from learning what the tools of improv are. And then I would mm-hmm. just get people from the audience up on stage and we play improv games. And that's what I do when I do these workshops is we...
You would do that right away. You would do that, the improv game.
30 minutes? Yeah, you jump right to the interesting part right away. That's one of our improv rules is get to the interesting part as soon as you can.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I actually done a CE on this for our state association last year. I did an improv CE.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and I did a lot more lecturing and I did get people involved. So I had pharmacists coming up and they were being funny. So pharmacists, we are funny, I promise you. And we were smiling and people were laughing and they weren't crying and afraid.
Yeah.
And which a lot of people get that anxiety in front of crowds. So I, with 30 minutes, like, let's get up here. Let's start playing some games and I'll explain. And as we play these games, that's what, when I explain, like, we played this game called, I'll use a real game. We played Zip Zap Zop. Here's what we learned. Here's what we used. Here's what you can learn from it. Great. Next game. We're going to play a game called Protest. Here's what we're going to play it. We played it. Here's what we did. Here's what we learned. How did that feel for those who did it? Great. Let's play another game. And so we can get up and play a few of these activities to put into use, because I love talking about improv. As you can tell, we've been going over an hour and,
yeah.
But I think the real bread and butter of it comes when you do it or you experience it or you're in a live show and you feel the energy of it as well. So lecturing for 30 minutes wouldn't be as powerful as seeing people just do it.
It seems that if you do it yourself, that would be a really good experience.
Mm-hmm.
If you see somebody do it and it's tied into business, mm-hmm. like you saying the zip, zap, zop, you learned this from it and you saw it.
Mm-hmm.
How much do they benefit by being an observer? Like I'm at home.
Yeah.
I'm watching this half hour. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to do improv. Let's say someone says that. I'll never do improv. Mm-hmm. Can they learn from just watching it, or is the next step to say, you should join Corey's online, you know, 2 hour something or other? Can they learn much just from watching it?
Lesson number one is yes and. So if the audience sitting at home takes that to heart, they're going to agree to listen to what is taught and apply what they did. So I think that if they really take that lesson to heart, they can learn from observing it. And I think that the participants at our CE, not everyone got to participate, you know, hands-on. They learned and they appreciated it. And the feedback was such that they were able to take those lessons and apply them to their practice. I think doing it and feeling it is a greater step because it helps you overcome that limiting belief that you maybe think you can't do something when you actually in fact can. but I know that I attended an improv session when I was a student. We had a keynote speaker that did improv, and that was another one of my steps of like, I want to do that someday. But the audience members get a lot out of it, even if they're not everyone is doing the games.
Even if they're not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
How much does a crowd change something? Like, let's say that you came into the office here, okay?
Yeah.
You come in here and you say, there's three options. Mm-hmm. One is you put me in a soundproof booth with no cameras and you say, here's an improv thing. I'm going to lock all the doors. You can do it by yourself. Just, mm-hmm. And you probably can't do it with one person, but let's say you're one person.
Sure.
Versus you being in a room with them, yeah, versus saying, we're going to have one person is going to watch us what we're doing. Does that throw it if someone has an audience of even one?
I think that for me, improv is a lot about energy. And so yeah, if you have a larger group, that audience helps tremendously.
Oh, it helps. Yeah, I didn't think about that. I was thinking the negative part of it for someone who's nervous. But
yeah, no, and I think that having that larger group makes it a more enriching experience. It's that team environment that really can make it fun. But
yeah,
if you have an audience that's not engaged and you're not able to get them engaged, then it could be a detriment. Like, I've done improv shows where we know that we did good improv and the audience was just like checked out. They weren't into it. It was like, did you know you came to a comedy show tonight? Because we did some funny stuff. Like, we really were funny, but you can't control that. So, but I think having the larger audience is, for me, I enjoy that. But that's, I've grown to like that.
If you went to do an improv,
mm-hmm,
and they said that they were all pharmacists there,
yeah,
like you went to like a pharmacy event, but you weren't telling them, you were teaching them. You just said you were there as, you didn't tell them you're a pharmacist. You just said you're an improv group.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be a terrible audience, the pharmacists?
I don't want to get in trouble for future potential clients. I think it would be. You know, I've actually done a show where a lot of pharmacists came, and it was a lot of fun.
You've been honest the whole time, Corey, and now you're.
It would be a little less rambunctious than other audiences. Than
what other groups would match pharmacists? Is there anybody that would be worse?
Gosh, I don't know. Probably like accountants, like folks that sit behind desks all day. People that do like IT work, maybe.
Yeah,
I'm gonna just. Is there more groups I could insult? Because I could totally just keep naming.
Insult them. You either did a paper or a little study on distant education.
Yes. Long, long ago in pharmacy school.
All right. Here's the question.
Yeah.
You are living in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to move from there or far from there.
Correct.
You've studied the distant education.
Mm-hmm.
How can you put that to use to do your improv classes online?
I think that would be a little, just being quite honest with you, it'd be tougher to do that online versus the in-person. I think that something like we have going right now, if I was, you know, on a Skype call or whatever, you know, whatever the platform you want, and I was talking to a group of people, I think that if I had like a physical facilitator there to help direct them around, it could work. I think that the magic of improv, and something that we kind of lament as improvisers, as performers, is that it doesn't always translate to video quite as well. Like, you don't go and watch a lot of improv videos online. You see sketch comedy, Saturday Night Live, etc. But I mentioned that energy earlier, and improv is really a lot about that energy. Like, what are you getting from the audience? What are you getting from that person right across from you? What are you seeing in the eyes as you're looking at them? And so, not to paint myself into a corner and say that there's not a way to innovate, oh, I think that you could, but to really keep people engaged, to keep them out of their comfort zone, is to be live and in person.
What about, whose line is it anyway? Did a great job. Now, they weren't coaching. Is that what you're saying the difference is?
So yeah, they're performing live, and then we watch that. You know, they recorded it live. I think coaching would be more difficult to do that, to do that online. And then I think I'm just coming at it from a perspective like that live studio audience was big, so you had a lot of energy, so you could cut to the audience. Whereas like most improv theaters hold 20 to 40 people. So to get a video, grainy video from far with that, it doesn't translate. If, you know, we don't have a lot of, you know, improv videos online of performances per se.
Well, there you go, though. That's your marketplace hole.
Yeah.
You figure that out, mm-hmm, and then you get Tucson, yeah, and then you're
coaching all over the world via video.
that's great news that it's hard and it doesn't do well and this and that, because then you can, you know, if they have those like improv video like classes, probably somewhere, right?
I am being inspired by the second to investigate and look myself.
There you go. That's your thing.
This is all about whatever I need is the magic of what's coming out of the other person's mouth and brain in front of me. So
there's enough people that want to make that step, but they're not willing to say, I can make that step to a class. You know, they're always lurking. And by the video, you're going to just like pull them in.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think that's a lot of times that first step, I saw it on the back of a Bazooka Joe gum. I think it's like the first step is half the distance, or it's probably some much more heady person than Bazooka Joe. But yeah, people that take that first step into an improv class, or people that, or businesses that take that step into having me come and talk to them, there's a little bit of nerves with that, because it's an abstract idea. Selling improv is a difficult thing because improv is sort of not well known, but selling employee engagement and soft skill development is. So, but once those businesses take that leap, or that person takes that leap, they find that they are capable of so much more than they thought. Their self-limiting beliefs of I'm not funny, I'm introverted, I get nervous in front of crowds, it will either quickly or slowly melt away, depending on the person, but it will show itself. Your ability to interact will show itself through improvisation.
I'm just going to keep talking until I find something that you don't say yes and for. I'm pretty good at that. It's like my first word is like, nah.
Yeah.
That's not going to go.
Yeah.
Pharmacists who have heard this, what should their first step B to get acquainted with you?
To me, okay, so you can find me on LinkedIn. You and I met on LinkedIn. Corey Jenks is where I'm at. If you like Twitter, I'm at Corey Jenks PharmD. Instagram's a little bit more lighthearted, so it's at Pharmacomedian. And I'm actually, I have my website, improvrx.com is my business website, so you can go there and reach out to me directly. Corey.Jenks@gmail.com is another mode of getting a hold of me. I want to work with pharmacists. I want to work with doctors, nurses, any businesses that you think your employees could use some work on their soft skill development, their engagement. I'm here and I'm ready to go. And I'm excited for this newest chapter in my life to try to grow, because I've been doing this, improv for 7 years now. Yeah. And I feel very comfortable with it. And it's like, how do I grow it? How do I get more people involved in it? And there's the performing side, as I was telling you, but I love the training side, because I think there's a need and there's definite outcomes for it.
Yeah, it really sounds fascinating. It sounds like, boy, it sounds like something that pharmacists can use for inter-employee things and patients, and then just across the board. And not to exclude just maybe becoming a great improv.
Yeah, I didn't get into this expecting to become an improviser. I wanted to just have some fun, and it's turned into this wonderful life skill that I had. And so, yeah, and from the pharmacist side of things, I'll make a reference to it. There's an article in the American College of Clinical Pharmacy. I put it in my TLDR article that GPA is not maybe the best measure of residency candidates coming out of pharmacy school. They talk about work ethic, passion, adaptability, communication, personality fit. These are all, soft skills, things that you can learn doing improvisation and develop them and create, a strength in them for yourself.
It's such a dichotomy that improv has very, very strict rules, and you find your freedom in those rules. And someone explained marriage like that to me one time. It's like marriage is very strict rules where you vow yourself to one person and so on. Mm-hmm. But through that very strict rule is where you really have that freedom to become who you're meant to be, because you have that trust in the system to grow and be yourself and fail and those kind of things. And you can break those rules.
Sure.
And it breaks your freedom. By breaking a rule breaks your immense freedom to be who you are and to grow in that point in time, or a bigger point in time.
Certainly, yeah. That's the thing that people are most surprised about, is all the rules we talk about on the first day of an improv class or at an improv workshop that I do. But again, like you say, it provides you that freedom to explore, to build, to grow, and to focus on the things that are really important and not the things that are distracting, maybe.
Hey, Corey, it was a real pleasure.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for having me. And it was a blast talking improv and pharmacy and parenting and everything we covered today.
Really cool stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be watching, Corey.
Okay.
I'll either have to get down to Tucson there, or I'm waiting for your YouTube training or your first special like I talked about.
Right, yeah. Well, the second I got something on YouTube, I'm going to send it your way. So.
All right, we'll watch it. And then we'll talk again in a year, and you can see if I'm a better listener.
Sounds great. You're a fine listener today, I assure you. You are well on your way to being a fine improviser, should you choose.
Well, the listener doesn't know this, but I'm going to cut all the places in here where I've interrupted you.
Okay.
In fact, I think what I'm going to do, now that I think about it, is because I can manipulate all this, you know, just the same way I do people. And I'm going to put like a 3-second pause before every one of my responses.
To make it, yeah, you're really.
I'm going to have you cutting me off all the time.
Smart.
I always want to come out looking better.
Hey, you're the host. I'm but a mere.
Do what I want.
You do what you want. I'm but a mere guest here. I'm at your service and at your debt of gratitude for having me on.
You're a mere guest.
I'm but a mere guest, yes.
All right, Corey.
Yeah.
Take care.
Thank you.
Be in touch.
All right. Bye.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.